21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. Now more of 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Zoe Hieronymus.
It's all about soul. It's all about faith and a deeper devotion. It's all about soul. 'Cause under love is a stronger emotion.
Welcome to 21st Century Radio. I'm Zoe Hieronymus. Laura Kortner is our executive producer and Noah Dankner runs our board. Continuing with an ongoing discussion of the issue of wildlife survival, rights stewardship, and other ecosystem-related issues, Eva Sargent joins us tonight from Defenders of Wildlife. We're going to focus on the Southwest conservation in America and the Mexican gray wolf recovery in particular, both of which Eva is an expert. Defenders of Wildlife was founded in 1947. They are a major national conservation organization focused solely on wildlife and habitat conservation, as well as the safeguarding of biodiversity. They believe, as do we, in the inherent value of wildlife and the natural world. And this singular focus defines their important niche in the environmental and conservation community. And they tell me it serves also as the anchor for their organizational values. Thank you for joining us, Eva.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Yeah, well, it's so interesting to meet somebody that has such a broad perspective on such a big area like the Southwest. Can you give us first sort of a big picture oversight of the kinds of things you look at?
The Southwest United States, particularly southern Arizona, southern New Mexico, what makes it so interesting is that it's where the desert Southwest of the United States meets the tropics. And it's because we have these mountain ranges, which are called the Sky Islands. The sort of visual on that is that the mountain ranges are islands in a sea of grass and desert. And that gives you an incredible variety of habitats, you know, because you've got things up high and things down low, and you've got deserts that come together with more tropical areas. And so it just makes this incredibly gorgeous, incredibly biodiverse region that's unlike anywhere else. You know, a lot of people think the Southwest is just a dry desert, and mm-hmm. nothing could be further from the truth.
When people look to current news stories, there's a great deal on the Idaho wolves. We're talking specifically, though, this hour more about the Mexican gray wolf. What relationship is there between the two species?
The Mexican gray wolf, or the lobo, as people call it around here, is a subspecies of the gray wolf. So, you know, it's a cousin. And the lobo is the most endangered type of wolf in the world. So it's smaller. It's adapted to a different kind of environment. You know, a Mexican wolf is about the size of a German shepherd. And it's also incredibly endangered. There's only 85, more or less, in the wild in the entire world. So it's a different critter. It came, in sort of the evolutionary sense, it was one of the first wolves to come to North America, probably from Asia. And it's persisted in this kind of more rare, more unique state.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an old wolf, a very interesting wolf.
Well, and like all the wolves, you know, whether it's through mythology or family story or hunting legacy, they seem to be one of these animals that people love to hate.
You know, it's you're right. They do invoke a lot of passion, but people also love to love them. So, you know, you don't find anybody really that feels just kind of like, oh, wolves are okay. You know, they're all right.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone either loves them and feels very spiritually connected to them or very passionate about them in a positive way, or they harbor old-fashioned ideas, you know, Little Red Riding Hood type ideas,
yeah.
that they're evil and that they, you know, kill anything. And so it's an interesting animal just from that standpoint. But a lot of that old-fashioned thinking translates into a lot of conflict today.
Exactly. And that's why I mentioned it, because it interests me just sort of pathologically, if you will, how something from a mythology becomes a pathology emotionally. And I think much of the harboring hate we have towards grizzlies and other bears and wolves is inherently part of the storytelling that people who have never encountered wildlife, never lived among them, never had a reason to know them other than maybe in a zoo or a movie, would fall into, quote unquote, a trap. You know, it's a fascinating thing that we've sort of trapped our own nature by harboring such hatred.
Exactly, because if you really ask yourself what kind of animals are dangerous, you know, the most dangerous is undoubtedly our own species, followed shortly by probably mosquitoes, as disease vectors are responsible for more deaths.
Yeah.
But, you know, we don't quake in fear of each other all the time on mosquitoes. We think about these iconic wolves, grizzly bears.
Yeah, and lions. So let's talk about the basic of wolves, because I saw a really interesting little snippet from what was evidently a much longer documentary on wolves actually affecting the shape of a river.
You know, that is a really interesting story, and it's a great story about how nature works. For years, you've seen this story come out in the academic literature about how wolves reshaped things, particularly in Yellowstone National Park. Now, recently, you know, the story has been that wolves make the elk move around more. Now, they not only kill elk, but they make the elk move around more, and the elk stop browsing the aspens near the river off so short. And they come back, and birds come back, and fish come back. And, you know, just recently, there's been some more papers published that say that it seem to say that it's not completely wolves, you know, that maybe we've said a little too much about that, that mm-hmm. it's actually wolves and other effects, climate effects, and the history of the landscape. But nonetheless, wolves are incredibly important in shaping ecosystems. You know, they all top predators are. So they do have these great effects. They also keep the herds healthy. You know, they don't, unlike the human trophy hunter that wants the big bull in the prime of his life with the big rack, you know, the wolf wants the little weak one that's maybe sick or the really old one, and that really helps the whole herd, you know, because wolves don't want to expend energy they don't have to get lunch.
mm-hmm.
Like, we wouldn't want to walk to the restaurant 5 miles away if we could walk to the restaurant that was half a mile away.
Yeah, so talk to us a little bit about the history of the recovery program of the gray wolves and why you're so passionate about it.
Well, in general, you know, the recovery of gray wolves in this country, it's a fantastic conservation success story where this incredibly wide-ranging species, you know, there were millions of them, was just completely eradicated because of hatred, because of people perceive them as, you know, cattle killers, and then they take a few cattle, but not a whole lot. But it's that old bad reputation we're talking about. And so they were completely wiped out, and the wolves were brought back to Yellowstone National Park and to the Northern Rockies by reintroduction, mostly. And, you know, it's amazing that you can take something that's been eradicated and bring it back. And the Mexican wolf in the Southwest is even more amazing because they were actually completely extinct in the wild. The last ones were eradicated in the United States probably in the 1970s, and there was only a handful left in Mexico, and five what were thought to maybe be the last five wild Mexican wolves in existence were caught in Mexico and brought in for captive breeding. So this is a species that was essentially extinct. They had a handful of individuals left in the wild, and these individuals became the forebearers of every Mexican wolf alive today.
So interesting.
And that's a miracle.
Mm-hmm. It's like some of the buffalo breeding programs that have produced such healthy herd today when they were so decimated.
Yep.
And so when you start to look at, you know, what's good, what's not working, I mean, in all the protest about the Idaho's travail against the wolves and the efforts by so many to preserve them, and then the issues of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services, how does the FWS affect you all in terms of the MX gray wolf recovery?
Well, the what's going on nationally is that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service wants to walk away from gray wolf recovery when the job's not done. You know, they want to just delist wolves throughout the country, except for Mexican wolves, because at least they can recognize that when you only have about 85 in the entire world in the wild, you don't need to delist those. But the national delisting also causes problems for Mexican wolves. You know, it's all connected.
Sure.
And the service.
And what hunter, by the way, can stop and say, oh, well, wait, no, that's a lobo. Oh, no, that's
yeah,
a gray wolf. No, I can't shoot that one.
Right. Yeah.
Let me just shoot the other one on the other bank.
Yeah, it's a little bit crazy, mm-hmm. that sort of thinking. And the thing about the Mexican wolf is because the service is seeking to delist wolves nationally, and by the way, they got more comments against that than they've ever gotten on any single issue. Way over.
Well, and their own science, you know, I want to just stop on this point for a moment, because when they read their own papers will tell them they can't do some of the things they do. And yet it's like, who cares about the science, even their own science?
Yeah, they, you know, this the national delisting rule was peer-reviewed by an independent panel of really top scientists who said that the service did not follow the best science, which is, by the way, what's required by law. That they didn't follow the best science, that the science that they did use, which was generated in-house, was, you know, not the best, that they didn't even interpret that accurately. So they really have gotten a black eye, sort of scientific integrity, scientific goings-on. And they're kind of doing the same thing with Mexican wolves. There's because the rest of the wolves would be delisted, they are proposing to relist Mexican wolves as a subspecies, and that's a good thing. But at the same time, they want to completely change the management rules for how they manage the wolves on the ground. And that's really a mess and really concerning because it doesn't follow, like the gray wolf delisting rule, the new management rule does not follow the best science.
What I don't understand a lot, I don't understand a lot of things, but one of the things I don't understand in this issue of listing and then delisting animals. First they're extinct, then you get 75 and all of a sudden they're not extinct, or maybe 85 and they are still listed, but then 400 others aren't. I mean, how is it that they go about determining when a species is no longer in threat, you know, in peril of extinction, even if there's just such a mild recovery?
Yeah, there, you know, the ESA, the Endangered Species Act, says that they have to use the best available science, the best available data. And so what they have to do to determine if something deserves delisting is they have to ask themselves, have the threats been taken care of? You know, do the threats still exist? That's the first question. And then how many are there? And, you know, can they persist on their own? And that, the, you know, that's kind of the basic thing. But they have to use science. They can't just kind of hold their finger up to the wind and say, well, we feel like doing it this way, which is essentially what they tried to do for what they are trying to do for gray wolves.
And then the other issue, of course, is the management of any of, we're focused on wolves at the moment, so on the wolf population from one state to another. Like, for instance, aren't there some recent laws up for debate in Arizona, and it connects to other states like Idaho?
Yeah, luckily, those laws that were up, that are up for debate in Arizona, two of them just got vetoed by the governor, so we're very happy about that.
Oh, okay. I read all the petitions, and I sign so many. I'm never sure of which ones win
well,
and
it
lose.
Only happened, it only happened in the last 2 days.
Okay.
So this is good news.
That's very recent. That is good
there
news.
There were some really bad laws. You know, a lot of this, the stuff that's happening in Idaho and these bad laws in Arizona are all part of this sort of Tea Party states' rights kind of movement. You know, and a lot of the ones in Arizona weren't even constitutional, so I'm really happy that the governor had...
Share with our listeners a little bit about what they were trying to pass, because I think this is important, you know, for those of us who really do care about the integrity of biodiversity and the likely survival of humanity, you know, we can forego some of the locality of some people's thinking. But what specifically was the Tea Party trying to do at that point?
Well, one of the laws that they were trying to pass would just allow ranchers, property owners, to kill more Mexican wolves than were allowed under federal law. They, you know, it sort of changed the conditions so that they could shoot wolves on public land. So that, you know, is obviously state law can't trump federal law, but that doesn't seem to stop a lot of these real states' rightsy kind of laws. There was another one that would have permitted, that would have appropriated $250,000 for a sort of war chest for the state to sue the federal government over this new rule that I was just talking about, this change in the management. There was one that was just, there were actually four things. There was one that was just a sort of a statement, you know, one of these resolutions that just said wolves are bad and, you know, wolf recovery should occur in Mexico. And then there was a fourth one that called Mexican wolves varmints and said that if the federal government didn't provide funds for all these sort of vaguely stated ills supposedly caused by Mexican wolves, then the state would drop out of the program and would require that all the wolves be removed. And, of course, the state doesn't have the power to do that. They don't have the power to allow more killing of Mexican wolves than are allowed from federal law. They don't have the power to say that the wolves have to be removed from any area.
And also the thing that happens, and I noticed it even with the Mexican wolves, is that the area, the demographic area, that's not the right word, the territorial area that's best for them, whether it's a mountain range or a preserve or something, and everybody admits that that's where they belong, and then they say, but that's not the area that they can be in anymore. And then they want to move the entire population to some, it's like, you know, picking up the Indians and moving them to another land.
Exactly.
Let's move all the wolves to a new place.
That's what some of these Arizona bills were about, was sort of like, let's let Mexican wolves recover in Mexico. Well, Mexico has even less suitable habitat for Mexican wolves now than the United States does. And the U.S. has great habitat for Mexican wolves in the Grand Canyon ecoregion and in northern New Mexico, southern Colorado. And the best available science, which is actually the science of, believe it or not, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's own recovery team, has said that what needs to happen for Mexican wolves to recover is to establish two additional populations, one in the Grand Canyon ecoregion, one in northern New Mexico, southern Colorado. And that these two populations have to be linked with each other, and they have to be linked with the existing population, which is on the the eastern boundary where Arizona meets New Mexico. So that's what has to happen, and that's all this information about what has to happen, that there have to be these three populations and they have to be connected and there have to be so many wolves. All of this is recently peer-reviewed and published in the scientific literature. So the service knows what has to happen. They mm-hmm. know what Mexican wolves need, and yet this rule change that they're proposing, you know, it gives the current population a little bit of breathing room, but it actually makes it harder for wolves to recover because it says they can't go north of Interstate 40, which is south of these two areas that, you know, these populations need to be.
This was like the issue of the buffalo in Yellowstone.
Yeah.
You know, first they give them their habitat back, which is native and natural, and then they go, well, they can't be there anymore.
Yep.
Anyway, we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, I think that an obvious question sort of begs the hour, if you will, is, so who cares? You know, what's the importance of wolves in the ecosystem, in biodiversity, etc.? If you've just joined us, excuse me, our guest is Eva Sargent from Defenders of Wildlife. You can find them online at www.defenders.org.
Hi, this is Jim Mosma. I'm the Center Director of Second Chance Wildlife Center in Gaithersburg, Maryland. And if you'd like to learn more on how you can help wildlife, particularly those who are orphaned, sick, or injured, log on to our website at www.scwc, that stands for Second Chance Wildlife Center, .org. And meanwhile, you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Zohara Hieronymus.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. Remember, all our guests and links to their websites as well as our interviews are free in our audio archives and links on the front page at 21st21stcenturyradio.com. Eva Sargent joins us from Defenders of Wildlife. You can find them at www.defenders.org. I hope you all will and stay up to date. They do a magnificent job in so many ways of being able to help individuals, communities, states, nations do important things. So we are currently talking about the Southwest, and in particular the Mexican gray wolf survival, recovery, etc. But why were store wolves? I'm sure there are people thinking, well, who cares? Big deal.
You know, we talked earlier about how wolves are important predators that make the environment healthier for all the other animals and for us, you know, by preying on elk and deer and helping the diversity of plants and other wildlife. But we also, the other thing is wolves do for us, you know, even if you think, well, what's the big deal? You got to think about the economics of wolves. Ecotourism around wolf viewing is enormous. In the Yellowstone region, people literally line the roads in Yellowstone National Park to watch wolves, and 45% of the people who go to Yellowstone say that wolves are the animal they want to see most. And that translates into real dollars, at least $35 million a year going into the local economy. So even if you're not a wolf hugger, you know, you can look at how wolves make ecosystems healthier, how they take the sick animals and make the herds healthier, how they contribute to other ecological processes, and finally, the bottom line, how they bring money to rural communities.
You know, it's so interesting how many programs now seem to be advancing in a very positive fashion by protecting a certain animal and the biosystem that it's part of, that it becomes an ecotourism, hopefully not invading into the natural habitat. But it's so fascinating how dollar still wins. In this case, it's like all of a sudden it's really good business to save the bear, you know, on the Royal Islands in Canada, and it's great business to save the wolf because we get all this ecotourism. You know, hey, if that's what it takes, I'm all for it, just so we can, like, if that's what it takes for humanity to make sense of preserving life because they go, it's going to make the money. It's so strange. It's so counterintuitive. But so coming back to that, though, because you also have worked, you know, there are people who might think, like, we have fox in our area and they'll kill your chickens. And we've had that happen. And yeah, it happens. And we have dogs and sometimes they're out and they'll chase them away. So you all do a lot to help ranchers and others who may have a particular problem with in their cattle industry with wolves, even though, as you point out, it's about 1% of the cattle might be affected. You all maintain programs, though, that to help sort of with non-violent ways, non-lethal control methods.
Yeah, you know, it may be a small amount of, you know, an insignificant amount of livestock taken by wolves overall, but if they're your cows,
that's quite
a different story. So out of respect for that, and as a way to build tolerance for wolves in local communities, Defenders has worked for just years with ranchers on methods to keep livestock and wolves separate. And, you know, there's all kinds of things. A really simple thing is just to hire more cowboys. So we do that on a cost-share basis with the rancher. Maybe the rancher will provide the horse and the tack, and we'll pay the cowboy. And that just puts more people on the ground watching out. And wolves don't like to be around people. They don't like to approach, you know, when people are present. So that helps keep the cows safe, just more eyes and more boots on the ground. You can also use stuff called fladry, which is these strips of bright red or orange fabric that you hang from fences, and just their movement seems to deter wolves. So you can keep wolves out of a particular pasture, at least temporarily, by putting up fladry.
Well, you know what I do along those lines? People think it's funny. We have a big garden that's fenced in that the deer love to jump inside of. So we now put up those plastic flag banners that you see at car lots, the multicolored flags. That does it. You hang them low. It's same concept.
That's exactly the same concept.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just creates something that's visually disturbing to them. But you can do all kinds of things. You know, you can move cattle away from active dens by using supplemental feeding. You can use guard dogs. You can use a thing called turbo fladry, which is the same flags but with a little electric wire, so if they touch the fence with their nose, they get a little shock. So there's all kinds of things, and, you know, ranchers sometimes have the best ideas. So we like to go out, talk to the ranchers, you know, understand their operation, understand what their concerns are, and then try to come up with a solution.
And then, of course, so when you listen to people talk about the drought that, as an example, hitting California or hitting the southwest of this country, the drought doesn't just affect people's ability and their golf courses or their lawns or drinking water. It affects all the wildlife as well.
Yes, it does, and it affects the it affects the elk, and that affects the wolves. It affects the livestock. It affects everyone.
Well, you know, can I ask you a question while I'm thinking of it? Because I read a report that said, firstly, more hunters kill more elk than wolves do, and that the reason certain states like to eliminate the wolves is so that the hunters have more elk to kill, and that they actually do that on purpose for hunting reasons.
That is true. That is why a lot of the states try to keep all predators down and keep these sort of artificially inflated levels of game animals for hunters to hunt. The study that I think you're thinking about is actually not that hunters kill more elk than wolves. They do, obviously, because there's not that many wolves, but actually that just poaching
Yeah.
If, you know, illegal poaching takes more elk than
yeah,
wolves.
Yeah, that was it.
So it's pretty outrageous. The you know, the idea that you can't give up a little bit to share with other species is kind of, you know, I personally have nothing against hunting. Hunting is a good way, when done ethically, for people to get out and connect with nature. But you, the
yeah, for it's, if it's for a reason of eating, I don't
yeah,
support go they, out there and have a good time with the guys and go kill a few things. I mean, you know, let me show my kid how to kill a few things and have a good day with the guys. Anyway, people hate it when I do this, but it's like, it's just one of those things. Even when I was a little child, it just has never sat well with me.
I'll never forget when I was a kid and my father killed a moose,
mm-hmm.
and I'll never forget how a moose is a gigantic animal, and I will never forget how long we ate moose meat.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if it's for eating, it you know, the whole life cycle makes sense, and one species supports the other, and there's some sort of reverent, you know, respect about the whole process. But one of the things Defenders of Wildlife looks at, which I'm so grateful for, is you do look at climate change and how this is impacting all of the work that we're all doing.
We do, and we do a lot of climate change policy work, trying to make sure that, especially that federal agencies and state agencies are prepared to help wildlife adapt to climate change. You know, because it's not just about wildlife, it's about everyone. It's about us, too. It's about having enough water for people and still being able to share with animals. You know, people are starting to realize that wildlife is not a luxury item. It's biodiversity that sustains us, you know, that provides these ecological services like cleaning the water, producing oxygen, you know, just small things we need, like
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
like crops that actually produce fruit, you know.
Yeah.
Just little things like this. People are starting to realize that and starting to realize that wildlife is not a luxury and that we're going to have to adapt to climate change together.
And I also think I really feel like we have a very great challenge because so much of our society is an urban society that has very little relationship to any kind of nature. We're not even talking about wildlife. I'm talking about a cardinal, you know, or a worm.
That's true, and that
so it's
worries
very,
me.
Well, I think that's one of the great challenges of our educational system of bringing this kind of very real and natural exposure that, and of course, No Child Left in the Woods. That wasn't the exact title of the book, but it was a wonderful book on this theme of what has happened to our educational system in our urban environments. We have generations now of citizens who have absolutely no experience of nature. I'm not talking about wolves and bears or fox. I'm just talking about the littlest things. Dandelions are growing food in your backyard.
Mm-hmm. Then the great thing is you can get that appreciation of nature in that little way.
Yeah.
By seeing sparrows and growing food in your backyard. So it doesn't. A little touch of nature is like magic. You know, and if you interview adults about this, they'll tell you things from their childhood that are hard to replicate today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but some of them are very simple. You know, they're not, I went to Yellowstone and saw a grizzly bear there. I went to the ditch at the end of my road
yeah.
and I collected tadpoles.
Exactly. Exactly. And so as we look at climate change, I mean, the Bloomberg School of Public Health came out with some horrifying but very real analysis. And it's funny, you mentioned one of them earlier in the program, which is the mosquito. These insect vector-borne diseases or rat vector diseases or other things that, you know, are in plentitude. It's so interesting what you said about the mosquito. You don't hear people screaming, let's kill all the mosquitoes.
Yeah, that's exactly true. And, you know, one of the reasons that I'm concerned and everyone at Defenders is concerned about these big predators is we believe that they are key to keeping ecosystems healthy
yeah.
and keeping things in balance. And I think they can help us as things kind of change with climate change. They can help us as sort of ecosystem engineers
mm-hmm.
and sort of these animals that keep everything together and hopefully, you know, bring some balance. I think if we start to lose all our predators at the same time that the climate is changing so rapidly, then we've got a double dose of trouble.
Yeah, and I've read reports about that as well, and it's very logical when you think about it. But I also noticed, for instance, here in our county of Baltimore, the coyote have come in because there was such a long winter, and it was so difficult for so many animals to eat. And you see it with, you know, small black bears coming into neighborhoods where they've never been because they lived up in the mountains, but then as they get displaced. So displacement is a really serious issue. When you work on conservation and biodiversity in the Southwest, what kinds of issues along those lines come up for you?
Well, we have in Tucson, which, you know, is a fair-sized city, we have mountain lions that sometimes come into the city. And people who live on the outskirts of the city definitely have javelina and mountain lions and bobcats. And they don't usually cause many problems, actually. Most people kind of enjoy them. Tucson's a very sort of nature-centric city. But, you know, I see coyotes on my street, and I live in the middle of the city.
Wow.
One three-legged coyote that I see routinely. But we have, all over the country, we have moved into their territory, mm-hmm. and or they're being displaced by, as you said, drought and climate change and lack of food. And so we're going to have to reach some understanding where, you know, there's respectful ways to live with wildlife. You know, from bear-proof dumpsters to not leaving out your cat food for raccoons. You know, we need to reestablish that respect and learn how to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, we're going to take our last break of the evening, and then we'll come back, continue our discussion. Eva Sargent is our guest. She's from Defenders of Wildlife. She's the program director for the Southwest, and I encourage you to go to their website. I follow them daily, www.defenders.org. They always give you the latest on what's happening to some beloved creature worldwide or some biodiverse area we all should be involved in some way.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Arnold, Director of Canine Assistance, www.canineassistance.org, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Zohara Hieronima.
Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. Eva Sargent is our guest from Defenders of Wildlife. You can find them at www.defenders.org. We're talking about the Southwest of America, conservation, and the Mexican wolf recovery. So I want to come a little bit to the specifics about wolves in case our audience doesn't know that much about them. And I know I sometimes do know certain things and not others. Like, how old do wolves live till in general in the wild?
In the wild, 6 or 7 years. They're not a super long-lived species.
Mm-hmm. Better than the field mouse, which is generally a year.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly. Has enough time to have pups and have a good life.
Mm-hmm. And what's their average range of territory?
That is a good question. A Mexican gray wolf has a I might actually have to look that up.
Well, for instance, like, you know, some wolves will range like 50 or 60 miles and some
how far? They will range a long way. They mm-hmm. can easily walk hundreds of miles. Their hunting territories are a bit smaller, but they will easily walk a couple hundred miles looking for mates or looking for a new territory.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes them so interesting. And that's why if you really want them to recover, you can't sort of keep them within boundaries because, you know, the definition of recovery is sort of grow the population bigger and have it take up more area, let them disperse.
Versus just trying to have a certain number in a certain area. Like in Idaho, when they decided that they wanted to manage their wolf population, they did hunting and aerial killing and just sort of mass slaughters of whole packs, not even like an intelligent like thinning out of a pack of taking the old ones, but even taking the mothers and the pups.
Yeah, Idaho has blown it so badly from their story of, you know, let us manage them and we'll manage them wisely. They are trying to manage them back down to extinction. They are, you know, determined to bring them down to the absolute lowest limit before they would have to be listed under the Endangered Species Act again.
And their reason is for the hunting of the elk, primarily?
That's their stated reason, but there's a real deep, we talked about this earlier, just a real deep visceral hatred of wolves among some people, and it's not even, you know, based on fact. You'll see all kinds of incredibly hateful statements all over the internet, you'll see pictures of men wearing like masks to cover their faces and holding up wolf carcasses. You know, it's all become this sort of odd states' rightsy kind of taking back America kind
and
of.
And so, killing the wolf is sort of like the banner of your autonomy or something.
That's about as close as I can get. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to explain.
It's peculiar. It interests me so much that to kill something wild with a gun somehow or other makes you feel superior and more in control. It's just so, anyway, I think to any thinking person, it's just so illogical as to be ridiculous.
It's interesting. You know, if you look at Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, he talks about hunting boar in that book.
Yeah.
And if you read the passage where he actually kills a boar, he has that same feeling, and he's a little bit ashamed of it, and he's surprised of the feeling of power and control
mm-hmm.
and almost giddiness that he gave him. So there is something very primal about hunting.
Yeah.
It's really
mm-hmm.
interesting.
Well, it must be so. I mean, when we think about the millennium, that's the only way one survived. We're sort of hardwired in our reptilian brain to fight or flight, and that's what we do. But
yes,
when you evolve, you know, presumably you can come into dominion over yourself rather than letting those instinctual sort of impulses rule. But nonetheless, that's a whole societal transition that we're moving in, and we're just living in that.
We have our tiny, you know, old-fashioned brains up against millions of years of evolution,
mm-hmm.
so it's a slow transition for us humans.
Mm-hmm. No, it's very true, but I think this challenge of Earth changes and the issue of not only whole human populations being decimated, but whole wildlife populations being decimated. I mean, we're talking about such a colossal change on this planet over the next couple hundred years, thousands of years, but we're beginning to see the beginning of the thousands of year cycle. And it's it interests me to see how we respond to the needs of the wild and the needs of, you know, the person next door. One of the other things that defenders of wildlife have worked on are the Florida manatee. I have followed your campaigns and the efforts you've made.
Yeah, our Florida staff has done some great work with both the manatee and the Florida panther. We have some great folks in Florida working on that issue. And the manatees, you know, they're another species that there's just so few of, and the panthers, you know, even fewer than that. So all these species, these iconic species, you know, they not only are important for themselves, they're also sort of stand-ins for all the stuff that we don't know about, you know, the bugs and the, you know, all the kinds of little critters. You know, these are kind of the flagships. If we can keep them going and keep them alive and get them recovered, they carry these whole ecosystems with them of all these other critters.
Mm-hmm. And then the work you do a lot of work in the Northwest as well.
Yes, we do. Defenders is everywhere. We do all kinds of work. We do, you know, direct work with the critters, and we also do political work. We do a lot of policy work. We have a lot of policy experts and science experts that do a lot of that kind of work to inform agencies about best practices, to come up with new ways.
And it's so interesting how the habitat conservation really is inseparable from the species conservation. And then it sort of wraps up with climate change and renewable energy. I mean, really all of these, we're talking about one massive sort of synergistic.
Yes, we are. And we do a lot of work out of my office in Tucson on renewable energy, on just making sure that renewable energy is what we call smart from the start, which means, yes, we understand renewable energy is needed, but if you're going to blade off the desert and put in a big solar plant, do it right. Do it in the right place. Do it in the place that's already disturbed.
How is the public sort of attention span for solar and renewables in that part of the world? Because it's certainly not the East Coast nor living close to Washington, D.C.
You know, people are very supportive here. They see it as a real economic boom for Arizona because we have so much sunlight,
mm-hmm.
and New Mexico has a lot of wind. So it is seen as a real economic win, and at Defenders, we're just making sure, like I said, that it's done right. That, you know, we always have to tell the story that you don't have to sacrifice nature in order to meet your needs. You just have to take more care to do what you're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
Give it more thought. Give it more planning.
And then you all also work at the international level. I mean, you have collaborators who work with you in different parts of the world.
We do. We have an international program that works mostly on international regulations like CITES, the Convention on Trade in Endangered Species. We have an office in Mexico City that works mostly on endangered parrots and endangered marine mammals.
And one of the efforts that I was involved in for on and off for about 15 years is all of the oceanic tests that are so deafening to our sea mammals.
Yeah, that is a huge issue, the kind of the sonar and the underwater noise.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that's very complicated that, you know, requires a lot of research. But I think we know enough to know it's harmful. Now it's just a question of how do we prevent it? How can we do what we need to do and not harm these animals?
Mm-hmm. And how did you get involved in this work, Eva?
I got involved. I started out my career working in zoos, actually. Working with zoo animals, trying to get, you know, as you said, people in the cities are so disconnected. I mm-hmm. started out working, and in the zoos, I mostly did zoo conservation programs in the wild, actually connected to the zoo. For example, I worked in Madagascar on a lemur reintroduction.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day I just decided I wanted to go work for a big national conservation organization, and I think I found the best one. So
how wonderful. And in terms of the Southwest, what are the things other than the gray wolf that you're working, that issue of the Mexican wolf, what are your other sort of primary areas that you work in?
Well, like I said, we work on renewable energy and energy transmission, and we work on jaguars. Jaguars, people think of them as tropical cats, but they do range into southern Arizona, southern New Mexico. And in the old days, they ranged into Texas. They ranged as far north as the Grand Canyon. Jaguars are not strictly, you know, lowland tropical sort of jungly cats. So we work on jaguars. We work on ocelots. We work on the border wall, the big wall on the border, and how to mitigate that, because that's like the ultimate example of habitat fragmentation is to put
and
up a
where
wall.
And where is the border wall?
Pretty much all along the Arizona-Mexico border.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and the only species that it doesn't keep out is humans.
It's fascinating. When you look at all of these various animals' habitats and that they're all interconnected, is it primarily the encroachment through further development that's making it such an issue, or is it the lack of natural resources inherently, like the death of a forest or the contamination of a river, or is it all of these things?
It's all those things. It's you know, it's death from a thousand cuts.
Mm-hmm.
It's drought, it's deforestation, and of course drought makes deforestation worse. It's not all timber cutting.
Right.
It's also just the forest dying from drought and from the heat. It's development, it's housing, it's transportation, it's air pollution, it's water pollution. It's everything. And
when I imagine, rightly so, as waters rise, millions and millions of people being on the move at the same time on this planet, wildlife's going to be on the move at the same time.
Exactly.
I mean, people don't think about that. You know, when you're walking down the city to look for something to eat, well, the cat from the mountain's going to be down in the city, too, looking for something to eat.
That's very true. That's, you know, we don't know exactly how things are going to move, but things are already moving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, both plants and animals are starting to shift in this hemisphere to the north where it's cooler and starting to shift up in altitude. And particularly here in our sky islands, those mountains I described at the beginning of our talk, you know, you can only shift up so high.
Yeah.
Until the top of the mountain is cooked, and then you got nowhere to go. And we have several species that are in that situation.
Meaning you're watching species move from the lowlands to higher lands, and you're watching plants do the same. Is that what you're talking about?
Yep.
Which is what we're all... Exactly. I used to joke, buy Appalachian land, you know, go along the Appalachian Trail. So that's going to be the million-dollar properties in the future.
Yep. And then, of course, you've got the forest fire issue, too.
Yeah.
As the forest dries out. And, you know, we are just having these enormous forest fires in the Southwest, just what they call stand-replacing fires, which means, you know, burn down everything.
Mm-hmm. What happens in those instances with some wildlife obviously gets out, but a great deal doesn't?
You know, it's amazing how wildlife can escape from forest fires. It's kind of a miracle. We had a fire 2 years ago that burned over, I think, three different Mexican wolf dens, and yet those pups survived.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like before the earthquakes and tsunamis, these animals, so many of them know, and they move far away from wherever they are.
Yeah.
Well, go ahead.
The real problem with these huge fires is that some of these, you know, the ground is so heated that the forest will never come back like it was.
Mm-hmm.
And so if there's particular forest plants that are a food source for some very specific, you know, animal that only eats a few different kinds of plants, you're going to lose those animals too. That's the real problem. It's not necessarily the ones that, you know, get burned in the fire or die directly during the fire. It's later.
Yeah.
If it doesn't come back.
So for everybody in the listening audience, we have about a minute. What would you urge them to do?
I would urge them, if they want to help wolves and Mexican wolves particularly, the easiest thing to do is to go to Defender's website, hit a tab at the very top of the first page that says Take Action, and sign up for the news and the alerts after you hit that tab, because that means you'll get our alerts, and when we're doing something good for wildlife, you'll hear about it. You'll know. You'll keep up to date. And, you know, sometimes it's something that seems kind of odd. We need you to go to a hearing in your town and talk, you know, positively about wolves. And, boy, if you think a hearing sounds boring, you've never been to a hearing where Defenders of Wildlife is there, you know, helping people do their testimony and making it fun and, you know, giving prizes and whatever. So it's really fun to sign up for our news and alerts. So just go to defenders.org, hit Take Action tab, and then sign up for news and alerts, and you'll be in the know.
Yeah, you will. Well, I'm on your e-list, and I think I get wonderful petitions from you all to participate in around the country. And there was a point in my life where I wouldn't sign petitions for other states. I'm over it. I went,
yeah,
you know
you
what?
Know,
I'm going to add my name to that cause because I believe
you know,
in it.
I want the Mexican wolf, the lobo, to be as important to people nationally as the gray wolf in the Yellowstone and the Northern Rockies.
All right, there we go. On Eva's account, we will chant for the Mexican gray wolves and the lobos all over. Thank you all for being with us. And Eva, thank you so much from Defenders for being with us this evening.
I hope you have more happy ever after. I hope we can all hope fearlessly.
Stimulating talk around the clock and breaking news now on Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio.